of every shade from midnight black to albino, were Milats. They slipped him phone numbers, they gave him blowjobs in public places, they crossed crowded bars to buy him a drink, they pulled him into taxis, they followed him home. Whatever it was, the Roman nose, the eyes like a dark sea, the skin like chocolate, the hair like curtains of black silk, or maybe just his pure, simple stink, it sure as hell worked. Now, don't be jealous. There's no point. There have always been and always will be people who simply exude sex, who breathe it, who sweat it. A few examples from thin air. The young Brando, Madonna, Cleopatra, Pam Grier, Valentino, a girl called Tamara who lives opposite the London Hippodrome, right slap in the middle of town, Imran Khan, Michelangelo's David. You can't fight that kind of marvellous, indiscriminate power, for it is not always symmetry or beauty per se that does it. Tamara's nose is ever so slightly bent, and there are no means by which you can gain it. Surely the oldest American sentence is relevant here, pertinent to matters economic, politic, and romantic. You either got it, or you don't. And Milat had it, in spades. He had the choice of the known world, of every luscious female from a size 8 to a 28, Thai or Tongan, from Zanzibar to Zurich, his vistas of available and willing pussy extending in every direction as far as the eye could see. One might reasonably expect a man with such a natural gift to dip into the tun dishes of a great variety of women, to experiment far and wide. And yet Milat Iqbal's main squeezers were almost all exclusively size 10, white, Protestant women aged 15 to 28, living in and around the immediate vicinity of West Hampstead. Initially, this neither bothered Milat nor felt unusual to him. His school was full of girls who fitted the general description, by the law of averages, as he was the only guy worth shagging in Glenard Oak. He was going to end up shagging a large proportion of them. And with Corina Kane, the present amour, things were really quite pleasant. He was only cheating on her with three other women, Alexandra Andrusier, Polly Houghton, Rosie Dew, and this was a personal record. Besides which, Corina Kane was different. It wasn't just sex with Corina Kane. He liked her, and she liked him, and she had a great sense of humour, which felt like a miracle. And she looked after him when he was down, and he looked after her too, in his own way, bringing her flowers and stuff. It was both the law of averages and a lucky, random thing that had made him happier than he usually was. So that was that. Except Kevin didn't see it that way. One evening, after Corina had dropped him off at a Kevin meeting in her mother's Renault, Brother Hifan and Brother Tyrone crossed Kilburn Town Hall like two man mountains, determined to deliver themselves at the feet of Muhammad. They loomed large.
"Hey, Hifan, my speed! Tyrone, my man, why the long faces?"
But Brothers Hifan and Tyrone wouldn't tell him why the long faces. Instead, they gave him a leaflet. It was called, "Who is Truly Free? The Sisters of Kevin or the Sisters of Soho?" Milat thanked them cordially for it, then he stuffed it in the bottom of his bag. "How was that?" they asked him the following week. "Was it a good read, Brother Milat?" Truth was, Brother Milat hadn't got round to reading it, and to be honest, he preferred leaflets called things like "The Big American Devil," "How the United States Mafia Rules the World," or "Science Versus the Creator, No Contest." But he could see it seemed to matter to Brother Tyrone and Brother Hifan, so he said he had. They looked pleased and gave him another one. This one was called "Lycra Liberation, Rape and the Western World."
"Is light broaching your darkness, Brother Milat?"
asked Brother Tyrone eagerly at the following Wednesday's meeting.
"Are things becoming clearer?"
Clearer didn't seem to Milat to be exactly the right adjective. Earlier in the week, he had set aside some time, read both leaflets, and felt peculiar ever since. In 3 short days, Corina Kane, a darling of a girl, a real good sort who never really irritated him, on the contrary, who made him feel happy, chuffed, had irritated him more than she had managed in the whole year they'd been shagging. And no ordinary irritation, a deep, unsettleable, unsolvable irritation, like an itch on a phantom limb, and it was not clear to him why.
"Yeah, man, Tyrone,"
said Milat with a nod and a wide grin.
Crystal, mate, crystal.
Brother Tyrone nodded back. Millat was pleased to see he looked pleased. It was like being in the real-life mafia or a Bond movie or something. Them both in their black and white suits nodding at each other. I understand. We understand each other.
This is Sister Aisha, said Brother Tyrone,
straightening Millat's green bow tie and pushing him towards a tiny, beautiful black girl with almond eyes and high cheekbones.
She's an African goddess. Really? Said Millat, impressed. Whereabouts you from?
Clapham North, said Sister Aisha with a shy smile. Millat clapped his hands together and stamped his foot.
Oh, man, you must know the Redback Cafe.
Sister Aisha, the African goddess, lit up.
Yeah, man, that was my place from way back when. You go there. All the time. Wicked place. Well, maybe I'll see you round them gates sometime. It's nice to meet you, sister. Brother Tyrone, I've got to chip, man. My girl's waiting for me.
Brother Tyrone looked disappointed. Just before Millat left, he pressed another leaflet into his hand and continued holding his hand until the paper got damp between their two palms.
You could be a great leader of men, Millat, said Brother Tyrone.
Why did everybody keep telling him that? Looking first at him, then at Karina Kane, the curve of her breasts peeping over the car door, beeping her car horn in the street.
But at the moment, you are half the man. We need the whole man.
Yeah, wicked, thanks. You too, brother, said Millat, looking briefly at the leaflet and pushing open the doors.
Laters.
What's that? Asked Karina Kane, reaching over to open the passenger door and spotting the slightly soggy paper in his hand. Instinctively, Millat put the leaflet straight in his pocket, which was weird. He usually showed Karina everything. Now just her asking him grated somehow. And what was she wearing? Same belly top she always wore, except wasn't it shorter? Weren't the nipples clearer, more deliberate? He said,
nothing, grumpily.
But it wasn't nothing. It was the final leaflet in the Kevin series on Western women. The right to bear, the naked truth about Western sexuality. Now, while we're on the subject of nakedness, Karina Kane had a nice little body, all creamy chub and slender extremities, and come the weekend, she liked to wear something to show it off. First time Millat noticed her was at some local party when he saw a flash of silver pants, a silver boob tube, and a bare mound of slightly protruding belly rising up between the two with another bit of silver in the navel. There was something welcoming about Karina Kane's little belly. She hated it, but Millat loved it. He loved it when she wore things that revealed it. But now the leaflets were making things clearer. He started noticing what she wore and the way other men looked at her, and when he mentioned it, she said,
Oh, I hate that, all those leery old men.
But it seemed to Millat that she was encouraging it, that she positively wanted men to look at her, that she was, as the right to bear suggested, prostituting herself to the male gaze. Particularly white males, because that's how it worked between Western men and Western women, wasn't it? They liked to do it all in public. The more he thought about it, the more it pissed him off. Why couldn't she cover up? Who was she trying to impress? African goddesses from Clapham North respected themselves. Why couldn't Karina Kane?
I can't respect you, explained Millat carefully, making sure he repeated the words just as he had read them. Until you respect yourself.
Karina Kane said she did respect herself, but Millat couldn't believe her, which was odd, because he'd never known Karina Kane to lie. She wasn't the type. When they got ready to go out somewhere, he said,
You're not dressing for me, you're dressing for everybody.
Karina said she didn't dress for him or anybody, she dressed for herself. When she sang Sexual Healing at the pub karaoke, he said,
Sex is a private thing between you and me. It's not for everybody.
Karina said she was singing, not having sex in front of the rat and carrot regulars. When they made love, he said,
Don't do that. Don't offer it to me like a whore. Haven't you heard of unnatural acts? Besides, I'll take it if I want it. And why can't you be a lady? Don't make all that noise.
Karina Kane slapped him and cried a lot. She said she didn't know what was happening to him. Problem is, thought Millat, as he slammed the door off its hinges. Neither do I. And after that row, they didn't talk for a while.
About 2 weeks later, he was doing a shift in the palace for a little extra money, and he brought the matter up with Shiva, a newish convert, to Kevin, and a rising star within the organization.
"Don't talk to me about white women," groaned Shiva,
wondering how many generations of Iqbals he'd have to give the same advice to.
"It's got to the point in the West where the women are men. I mean, they've got the same desires and urges as men. They want it all the fucking time, and they dress like they want everyone to know they want it. Now, is that right? Is it?"
But before the debate could progress, Samad came through the double doors, looking for some mango chutney, and Milat returned to his chopping. That evening after work, Milat saw a moon-faced, demure-looking Indian woman through the window of a Piccadilly cafe, who looked, in profile, not unlike youthful pictures of his mother. She was dressed in a black polo neck, long black trousers, and her eyes were partly veiled by long black hair. Her only decoration, the red patterns of Mehndi on the palms of her hands. She was sitting alone. With the same thoughtless balls he used when chatting up dolly birds and disco brains, with the guts of a man who had no qualms about talking to strangers, Milat went in and started giving her the back page of The Right to Bear, pretty much verbatim, in the hope that she'd understand. All about soulmates, about self-respect, about women who seek to bring visual pleasure only to the men who love them. He explained,
"It's the liberation of the veil, innit? Look, like here. Free from the shackles of male scrutiny and the standards of attractiveness, the woman is free to be who she is inside, immune from being portrayed as sex symbol and lusted after as if she were meat on the shelf to be picked at and looked over. That's what we think," he said, uncertain if that was what he thought. "That's our opinion," he said, uncertain whether it was his opinion. "You see, I'm from this group."
The lady screwed up her face and put her forefinger delicately across his lip.
"Oh, darling," she murmured sadly, admiring his beauty. "If I give you money, will you go away?"
And then her boyfriend turned up, a surprisingly tall Chinese guy in a leather jacket. Deep in a blue funk, Milat resolved to walk the 8 miles home, beginning in Soho, glaring at the leggy whores and the crotchless knickers and the feather boas. By the time he reached Marble Arch, he had worked himself into such a rage, he called Karina Kane from a phone box plastered with tits and arse, whores, 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 and dumped her unceremoniously. He didn't mind about the other girls he was shagging, Alexandra and Rousier, Polly Houghton, Rosie Jew, because they were straight-up posh totty slags. But he minded about Karina Kane because she was his love, and his love should be his love and nobody else's, protected like Liotta's wife in Goodfellas or Pacino's sister in Scarface, treated like a princess, behaving like a princess in a tower, covered up. Walking slower now, dragging his heels, there being nobody to go home to, he got waylaid in the Edgware Road, the old fat guys calling him over.
"Look, it's Milat, little Milat, the ladies' man. Milat, the prince of pussy pokers. Too big to have a smoke, is he now?"
And gave in with a rueful smile. Hookah pipes, halal fried chicken, and illegally imported absinthe consumed around wobbling outdoor tables, watching the women hurry by in full purdah, like busy black ghosts haunting the streets, late-night shopping, looking for their errant husbands. Milat liked to watch them go. The animated talk, the exquisite colours of the communicative eyes, the bursts of laughter from invisible lips. He remembered something his father once told him back when they used to speak to each other. "You do not know the meaning of the erotic, Milat. You do not know the meaning of desire, my second son, until you have sat on the Edgware Road with a bubbling pipe, using all the powers of your imagination to visualise what is beyond the 4 inches of skin Hajib reveals, what is under those great sable sheets." About 6 hours later, Milat turned up at the Chalfant kitchen table, very, very drunk, weepy and violent. He destroyed Oscar's Lego fire station and threw the coffee machine across the room. Then he did what Joyce had been waiting for these 12 months. He asked her advice. It seemed like months had been spent across that kitchen table since then. Joyce shooing people out of the room, going through her reading material, wringing her hands, the smell of dope mingling with the steam that rose off endless cups of strawberry tea. For Joyce truly loved him and wanted to help him, but her advice was long and complex. She had read up on the subject, and it appeared Millat was filled with self-revulsion and hatred of his own kind, that he had possibly a slave mentality, or maybe a colour complex centred around his mother. He was far darker than she. Or a wish for his own annihilation by means of dilution in a white gene pool, or an inability to reconcile two opposing cultures. And it emerged that 60% of Asian men did this, and 90% of Muslims felt that. It was a known fact that Asian families were often, and hormonally boys were more likely to. And the therapist she'd found him was really very nice, 3 days a week, and don't worry about the money. And don't worry about Joshua, he's just sulking. And. Way back when, in the fuddle of the hash and the talk, Millat remembered a girl called Karina something or another, whom he had liked, and she liked him. And she had a great sense of humour which felt like a miracle, and she looked after him when he was down, and he looked after her too, in his own way, bringing her flowers and stuff. She seemed distant now, like conquer fights in childhood. And that was that. There was trouble at the Joneses. Irie was about to become the first Bowden or Jones, possibly, maybe, all things willing, by the grace of God, fingers crossed, to enter a university. Her A-levels were chemistry, biology, and religious studies. She wanted to study dentistry, white collar, 20K plus, which everyone was very pleased about, but she also wanted to take a year off in the subcontinent and Africa. Malaria, poverty, tapeworm, which led to 3 months of open warfare between her and Clara. One side wanted finance and permission, the other side was resolved to concede neither. The conflict was protracted and bitter, and all mediators were sent home empty-handed. She has made up her mind, there are no arguments to be had with the woman, Samad, or else embroiled in the war of words. Why can't she go to Bangladesh if she wants to? Are you saying my country is not good enough for your daughter? Alsana. The stalemate was so pronounced that land had been divided and allocated. Irie claimed her bedroom and the attic. Archie, a conscientious objector, asked only for the spare room, a television and a satellite, state, dish, and Clara took everything else, with the bathroom acting as shared territory. Doors were slammed, the time for talking was over. On the 25th of October 1991, 0100 hours, Irie embarked upon a late-night attack. She knew from experience that her mother was most vulnerable when in bed. Late at night, she spoke softly like a child. Her fatigue gave her a pronounced lisp. It was at this point that you were most likely to get whatever it was you had been pining for. Pocket money, a new bike, a later curfew. It was such a well-worn tactic that until now, Irie had not considered it worthy of this, her fiercest and longest dispute with her mother. But she hadn't any better ideas.
Irie, what? It's a middle of the night. Go back to bed.
Irie opened the door further, letting yet more hall light flood the bedroom. Archie submerged his head in the pillow.
Bloody hell, love. It's 1 in the morning. Some of us have got work tomorrow.
I want to talk to Mum, said Irie firmly, walking to the end of the bed.
She won't talk to me during the day, so I'm reduced to this.
Irie, please. I'm exhausted. I'm trying to get some sleep.
I don't just want to have a year off. I need one. It's essential. I'm young. I want some experiences. I've lived in this bloody suburb all my life. Everyone's the same here. I want to go and see the people of the world. That's what Joshua's doing, and his parents support him.
Well, we can't bloody afford it, grumbled Archie, emerging from the eiderdown. We haven't all got posh jobs in science now, have we?
I don't care about the money. I'll get a job, somehow, or something. I do want your permission, both of you. I don't want to spend 6 months away and spend every day thinking you're angry.
Well, it's not up to me, love, is it? It's your mother, really.
Yes, Dad, thanks for stating the bloody obvious.
Oh, right, said Archie, huffily, turning to the wall. I'll keep my comments to myself, then.
Oh, Dad, I didn't mean... Mum, can you please sit up and speak properly? I'm trying to talk to you. It seems like I'm talking to myself here.
Said Irie with absurd intonations, for this was the year Antipodean soap operas were teaching a generation of English kids to phrase everything as a question.
Look, I want your permission, yeah?
Even in the darkness, Irie could see Clara scowl.
Permission? For what? Could go and share and ogle that poor black folk? Dr. Livingstone, I presume. Is that what you learnt from the Shalvench? Because if that's what you want, you can do that here. Just sit and look at me for 6 months.
It's got nothing to do with that. I just want to see how other people live.
And get yourself killed in the process? Why don't you go next door? There are other people there. Go see how they live.
Infuriated, Irie grabbed the bed knob and marched round Clara's side of the bed. Why can't you just sit up properly and talk to me properly and drop the ridiculous little girl for... In the darkness, Irie kicked over a glass and sucked in a sharp breath as the cold water seeped between her toes and into the carpet. Then, as the last of the water ran away, Irie had the strange and horrid sensation that she was being bitten.
Ow! Oh, for God's sake,
said Archie, reaching over to the side lamp and switching it on.
What now?
Irie looked down to where the pain was. In any war, this was too low a blow. The front set of some false teeth, with no mouth attached to them, were bearing down upon her right foot.
Fucking hell! What the fuck are they?
But the question was unnecessary. Even as the words formed in her mouth, Irie had already put two and two together. The midnight voice, the perfect daytime straightness and whiteness. Clara hurriedly stretched to the floor and prized her teeth from Irie's foot and, as it was too late for disguise now, placed them directly on the bedside table.
Satisfied?
Asked Clara wearily. It wasn't that she had deliberately not told her. There just never seemed a good time. But Irie was 16 and everything feels deliberate at that age. To her, this was yet another item in a long list of parental hypocrisies and untruths. This was another example of the Jones-Bowden gift for secret histories, stories you never got told, history you never entirely uncovered, rumour you never unravelled, which would be fine if every day was not littered with clues and suggestions. Shrapnel in Archie's leg, photo of strange white Grandpa Durham, the name Ophelia and the word madhouse, a cycling helmet and an ancient mudguard, smell of fried food from O'Connell's, faint memory of a late nightcar journey, waving to a boy on a plane, letters with Swedish stamps, Horst Ibelgofts, if not delivered, returned to sender. Oh, what a tangled web we weave. Millat was right. These parents were damaged people, missing hands, missing teeth. These parents were full of information you wanted to know but were too scared to hear. But she didn't want it any more. She was tired of it. She was sick of never getting the whole truth. She was returning to sender.
Well, don't look so shocked, love, said Archie amicably. It's just some bloody teeth. So now you know. It's not the end of the world.
But it was, in a way. She'd had enough. She walked back into her room, packed her schoolwork and essential clothes into a big rucksack, and put a heavy coat over her nightie. She thought about the Chalfins for half a second, but she knew already there were no answers there, only more places to escape. Besides, there was only one spare room and Millat had it. Irie knew where she had to go, deep into the heart of it, where only the N-17 would take her at this time of night, sitting on the top deck, seats decorated with puke, rumbling through 47 bus stops before it reached its destination. But she got there in the end.
Lord of Jesus,
mumbled Hortense, iron curlers unmoved, bleary-eyed on the doorstep.
Irie Ambrosia Jones, is that you?
15. Chalfinism versus Bowdenism. It was Irie Jones, all right. 6 years older than the last time they met. Taller, wider, with breasts and no hair and slippers just visible underneath a long duffel coat. And it was Hortense Bowden. 6 years older, shorter, wider, with breasts on her belly and no hair, though she took the peculiar step of putting her wig in curlers, and slippers just visible underneath a long, padded, baby pink housecoat. But the real difference was Hortense was 84. Not a little old woman by any means. She was a round, robust one, her fat so taut against her skin the epidermis was having a hard time wrinkling. Still, 84 is not 77 or 63. At 84, there is nothing but death ahead, tedious in its insistence. It was there in her face as Irie had never seen it before. The waiting and the fear and the blessed relief. Yet, though there were differences, walking down the steps and into Hortense's basement flat, Irie was struck by the shock of sameness. Way back when, she had been a fairly regular visitor at her grandmother's, sneaky visits with Archie while her mother was at college, and always leaving with something unusual, a pickled fish head, chili dumplings, the lyrics of a stray but persistent psalm. Then, at Darcus's funeral in 1985, 10-year-old Irie had let slip about these social calls, and Clara had put a stop to them altogether. They still called each other on the phone, on occasion, and to this day, Irie received short letters on exercise paper with a copy of the watchtower slipped inside. Sometimes Irie looked at her mother's face and saw her grandmother, those majestic cheekbones, those feline eyes. But they had not been face to face for 6 years. As far as the house was concerned, 6 seconds seemed to have passed. Still dark, still dank, still underground. Still decorated with hundreds of secular figurines. Cinderella on her way to the ball. Mrs. Tiddlytum shows the little squirrels the way to the picnic. All balanced on their separate doilies and laughing gaily amongst themselves. Amused that anyone would pay £150 in 15 instalments for such inferior pieces of china and glass as they. A huge tripartite tapestry, which Irie remembered the sewing of, now hung on the wall above the fireplace, depicting, in its first strip, the anointed sitting in judgment with Jesus in heaven. The anointed were all blonde and blue-eyed and appeared as serene as Hortense's cheap wool would allow, and were looking down at the great crowd, who were happy-looking, but not as happy as the anointed, frolicking in eternal paradise on earth. The great crowd were in turn looking piteously at the heathens, by far the largest group, dead in their graves and packed on top of each other like sardines. The only thing missing was Darcus, whom Irie only faintly remembered as a mixture of smell and texture, naphthalene and damp wool. There was his huge empty chair, still fetid, and there was his television, still on.
Irie, look at you. Pick me not even got a gansy on. Child must be freezing, shivering like a Mexico bean. Let me feel you. Fever! You're bringing fever into my house?
It was important, in Hortense's presence, never to admit to illness. The cure, as in most Jamaican households, was always more painful than the symptoms.
I'm fine. There's nothing wrong with...
Oh, really?
Hortense put Irie's hand on her own forehead.
That's fever as sure as fever is fever. Feel it?
Irie felt it. She was hot as hell.
Come here.
Hortense grabbed a rug from Darcus's chair and wrapped it around Irie's shoulders.
Now come into the kitchen and seize and sickle. Running round on a night like this, wearing flimsy nonsense. You're having a hot drink of cereals and then gone to bed quicker than you ever did in your life.
Irie accepted the smelly wrap and followed Hortense into the tiny kitchen where they both sat down.
Let me look at you.
Hortense leant against the oven with hands on hips.
You look like Mr. Death, your new lover. How you get here?
Once again, one had to be careful in answering. Hortense's contempt for London transport was a great comfort to her in her old age. She could take one word like train and draw a melody out of it. Northern Line. Which expanded into an aria, the underground, and blossomed into a theme, the overground. And then grew exponentially into an operetta, the evils and inequities of British Rail.
Bus N17. It was cold on the top deck. Maybe I caught a chill.
I don't think there's any maybes about it, young lady. And I'm sure I don't know why you come upon the bus, when it take 3 hours to arrive and leave you waiting in the cold, and then when you get upon it, the windows are open anyway and you freeze half to death.
Hortense poured a colourless liquid from a small plastic container into her hand.
Come here.
Why? Demanded Irie, immediately suspicious. What's that?
Nothing. Come here. Take off your spectacles.
Hortense approached with a cupped hand.
Not in my eye. There's nothing wrong with my eye.
Stop fussing. I'm not putting nothing in your eye. Just tell me what it is,
pleaded Irie, trying to work out for which orifice it was intended, and screaming as the cupped hand reached her face, spreading the liquid from forehead to chin.
Ah! It burns!
Beerum, said Hortense, matter-of-factly.
Burns the fever away.
No, don't wash it off. Just leave it to do its business.
Irie gritted her teeth as the torture of 1,000 pinpricks faded to 500, then 25, until finally it was just a warm flush of the kind delivered by a slap.
So?
Said Hortense, entirely awake now, and somewhat triumphant.
You finally dashed from that godless woman, I see, and got a flu while you're doing it. Well, there are those who wouldn't blame you.
No, not at all. No one knows better than me what that woman be like. Never at home, learning all her isms and schisms in the university, leaving husband and pygmy at home, hungry and maugre. Lord, naturally you flee. Well,
she sighed and put a copper kettle on the stove.
It is written, you will flee by my mountain valley, for it will extend to Azel. You will flee as you fled from the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah. Then the Lord my God will come, and all the holy ones with him. Zechariah 14:5.
In the end, the good ones will flee from evil.
Oh, Irie Ambrosia, I knew you'd come in the end. All God's children return in the end.
Gwen, I haven't come to find God. I just want to do some quiet study here and get my head together. I need to stay a few months, at least till the new year.
Oh, ugh, I feel a bit woozy. Can I have an orange? Yes, they all return to the Lord Jesus in the end,
continued Hortense to herself, placing the bitter root of cerise into a kettle.
That's not a real orange, dear. All the fruit is plasticated. The flowers are plasticated also. I don't believe the Lord meant me to spend the little housekeeping money I possess on perishable goods. Have some dates.
Irie grimaced at the shriveled fruit plonked in front of her.
So you left Archibald with that woman? Poor thing. We always like Archibald,
said Hortense sadly, scrubbing the brown scum from a teacup with two soapy fingers.
It was never my objection as such. He always been a level-headed sort of fellow. Blessed are the peacekeepers. He always struck me as a peacekeeper, but it more the principle of the thing, you know. Black and white never come to no good. The Lord Jesus never meant us to mix it up. That's why he made a whole heap of fuss about the children of men building the Tower of Babel. He want everybody to keep things separate. And the Lord did confound the language of all the earth, and from thence did the Lord scatter them abroad upon the face of all the earth. Genesis 11:9. When you mix it up, nothing good can come. It wasn't intended. Except you,
she added as an afterthought.
You're about the only good thing to come out of that. Boy, sometime it like looking in a mirror glass,
she said, lifting Irie's chin with her wrinkled digits.
You built like me. Big, you know. Hip and tie and ras and titties. My mother was the same way. You even named after my mother.
Irie? Asked Irie, trying hard to listen, but feeling the damp smog of her fever pulling her under.
No, dear. Ambrosia. The stuff that make you live forever.
No,
she said, clapping her hands together, catching Irie's next question between them.
You sleeping in the living room. I'll get a blanket and pillows and then we talk in the morning. I'm up at 6, 'cause I got witness business. So don't think you're sleeping none after 8. Pickney, you hear me?
But what about Mum's old room? Can't I just sleep in there? Hortense took Irie's weight half on her shoulder and led her into the living room.
No, that's not possible. There is a certain situation,
said Hortense mysteriously.
That can wait till the sun is up to be explained. Fear them not, therefore, for there is nothing covered that shall not be revealed,
she intoned quietly, turning to go.
And nothing hid that shall not be known. That is Matthew 10:26.
An autumn morning was the only time worth spending in that basement flat. Between 6 and 7 a.m., when the sun was still low, light shot through the front window, bathed the lounge in yellow, dappled the long, thin allotment, 7 foot by 30 foot, and gave a healthy veneer to the tomatoes. You could almost convince yourself at 6 a.m. that you were downstairs in some continental cabana, or at least street level in Torquay, rather than below ground in Lambeth. The glare was such that you couldn't make out the railway sidings where the strip of green ended, or the busy everyday feet that passed by the lounge window, kicking dust through the grating at the glass. It was all white light and clever shade at 6 in the morning. Hugging a cup of tea at the kitchen table, squinting at the grass, Iris saw vineyards out there. She saw Florentine scenes instead of the uneven higgledy-piggledy of Lambeth rooftops. She saw a muscular, shadowy Italian plucking full berries and crushing them underfoot. Then the mirage, sun-reliant as it was, disappeared, the whole scene swallowed by a devouring cloud, leaving only some crumbling Edwardian housing. Railway sidings named after a careless child, a long, narrow strip of allotment where next to nothing would grow, and a bleached-out, bandy-legged, red-headed man with terrible posture and Wellington boots, stamping away in the mulch, trying to shake the remnants of a squashed tomato from his heel. "That is Mr. Tupps," said Hortense, hurrying across the kitchen in a dark maroon dress, the eyes and hooks undone, and a hat in her hand with plastic flowers askew. "He has been such a help to me since Dark has died. He soothes away my vexation and calms my mind." She waved to him and he straightened up and waved back. Irie watched him pick up 2 plastic bags filled with tomatoes and walk in his strange, pigeon-footed manner up the garden towards the back kitchen door. "And he the only man who made a solitary thing grow out there. Such a crop of tomatoes as you never did see. Irie Ambrosia, stop staring and come undo up this dress. Quick before your goggle eye fall out." "Does he live here?" whispered Irie in amazement, struggling to join the 2 sides of Hortense's dress over her substantial flank. "I mean, with you."
"Not in the sense you meanin'," sniffed Hortense. "He is just a great help to me in my old age. He been with me these 6 years. God bless him and keep his soul. Now, pass me that pin."
Irie passed her the long hat pin which was sitting on top of a butter dish. Hortense set the plastic carnation straight on her hat and stabbed them fiercely, then brought the pin back up through the felt, leaving 2 inches of exposed silver sticking up from the hat, like a German pickle hober.
"Well, don't look so shocked. It's a very satisfactory arrangement. Women need a man about the house, otherwise ting and ting get messy. Mr. Tupps and I, we old soldiers fighting the Battle of the Lord. Some time ago he converted to the Witness Church, and his rise has been quick and sure. I've waited 50 years to do something else in the Kingdom Hall except clean," said Hortense sadly. "But they don't want women interfering with real church business. But Mr. Tupps do a great deal, and him let me help on occasion. He's a very good man, but him family are nasty, nasty," she murmured confidentially. "The father is a terrible man, gambler, an oramonger. So after a while I asked him to come and live with me, seeing how the room empty and dark has gone. Him a very civilized boy. Never married though. Married to the church, yes sir. And him called me Mrs. Bowden these 6 years, never anything else."
Hortense sighed ever so slightly.
"Don't know the meaning of being improper. The only thing he want in life is to become one of the anointed. I have the greatest admiration for him. He improved so much. He talks so posh now, you know. And him very good with the piping and plumbing also. How's your fever?"
"Not great. Last hook. There, that's done."
Hortense fairly bounced away from her and walked into the hall to open the back door to Ryan.
"But Gran, why does he live..."
"Well, you're going to have to eat up this morning. Feed a fever, starve a cold. These tomatoes fried with plantain and some of last night's fish. I'll fry it up and then pop it in the microwave."
"I thought it was starve a fever."
"Good morning, Mr. Tupps."
"Good morning, Mrs. Bowden,"
said Mr. Tupps, closing the door behind him and peeling off a protective cagoule to reveal a cheap blue suit with a tiny gold cross pendant on the collar.
"I trust you is almost of a readiness.
We've got to be at the hall on the door of 7.
As yet, Ryan had not spotted Irie. He was bent over shaking the mud from his boots, and he did it formidably slowly, just as he spoke, and with his translucent eyelids fluttering like a man in a coma. Irie could only see half of him from where she stood, a red fringe, a bent knee, and the shirt cuff off one hand. But the voice was a visual in itself, cockney yet refined, a voice that had had much work done upon it, missing key consonants and adding others where they were never meant to be, and all delivered through the nose with only the slightest help from the mouth.
"Fine morning, Mrs. B, fine morning. Something to thank the Lord for?"
Hortense seemed terribly nervous about the imminent likelihood that he should raise his head and spot the girl standing by the stove. She kept beckoning Irie forward and then shooing her back, uncertain whether they should meet at all.
"Oh, yes, Mr. Tapps, it is, and I am ready can be. My head give me a little trouble, you know, but I just got a pin and...
But the Lord ain't interested in the vanities of the flesh now, is he, Mrs. B?"
said Ryan, slowly and painfully enunciating each word while crouching awkwardly and removing his left boot.
"Jehovah is in need of your soul."
"Oh, yes, surely that is the holy truth,"
said Hortense anxiously, fingering her plasticated carnations.
"But at the same time, surely a witness lady don't want look like a, well, a boogayaga in the house of the Lord."
Ryan frowned.
"My point is, you must avoid interpreting scripture by yourself, Mrs. Bowden. In future, discuss it with myself and my colleagues. Ask us, is pleasant clothing a concern of the Lord's? And myself and my colleagues amongst the anointed will look up the necessary chapter and verse."
Ryan's sentence faded into a general ahem, the sound he was prone to making. It began in his arched nostrils and reverberated through his slight, elongated, misshapen limbs like the final shiver of a hanged man.
"I don't know why I do it, Mr. Tapps," said Hortense, shaking her head. "Sometime I think I could be one of them that teach. You know, even though I am a woman, I feel like the Lord talked to me in a special way. It's just a bad habit, but so much in the church changed recently. Sometimes me can't keep up with all the rules and regulations."
Ryan looked out through the double glazing. His face was pained.
"Nothing changes about the word of God, Mrs. B. Only people are mistaken. The best thing you can do for the truth is just pray that the Brooklyn Hall will soon deliver us with the final date."
"Oh, yes, Mr. Tapps, I do it day and night."
Ryan clapped his hands together in a pale imitation of enthusiasm.
"Now, did I hear you say plantain for breakfast, Mrs. B?"
"Oh, yes, Mr. Tapps, and them tomatoes, if you will be kind enough to hand them over to the chef."
As Hortense had hoped, the passing of the tomatoes coincided with the spotting of Irie.
"Now, this is my granddaughter, Irie Ambrosia Jones, and this is Mr. Ryan Tapps. Say hello, Irie dear."
Irie did so, stepping forward nervously and reaching out her hand to shake his. But there was no response from Ryan Tapps, and the inequality was only increased when on the sudden he seemed to recognize her. There was a pulse of familiarity as his eyes moved over her, whereas Irie saw nothing, not even a type, not even a genre of face in his. The monstrosity of him was quite unique, redder than any redhead, more freckled than the freckled, more blue-veined than a lobster.
She's Clara's daughter," said Hortense tentatively. "Mr. Tapps knew your mother long time. But it's all right, Mr. Tapps. She come to live with us now."
"Only for a little time," Irie corrected hurriedly, noting the look of vague horror on Mr. Tapps's face. "Just for a few months, maybe, through the winter while I study. I've got exams in June." Mr. Tapps did not move. Moreover, nothing on him moved. Like one of China's terracotta army, he seemed poised for battle, yet unable to move.
"Clara's daughter," repeated Hortense in a tearful whisper. "She might have been yours."
Nothing surprised Irie about this final, whispered aside. She just added it to the list. Ambrosia Bowden gave birth in an earthquake. Captain Charlie Durham was a no-good jam fool boy. False teeth in a glass. She might have been yours. Half-heartedly, with no expectation of an answer, Irie asked, What?
Oh, nothing, Irie dear, nothing. Let me start frying. I can hear bellies rumbling. You remember Clara, don't you, Mr. Tapps? You and she were quite good friends, Mr. Tapps.
For 2 minutes now, Ryan had been fixing Irie with an unwavering stare. His body held absolutely straight, his mouth slightly open. At the question, he seemed to compose himself, closed his mouth, and took his seat at the unlaid table.
Clara's daughter, is it?
He removed what looked like a small policeman's pad from his breast pocket and poised a pen upon it as if this would kickstart his memory.
You see, many of the episodes, people, and events from my earlier life have been, as it were, severed from myself by the almighty sword that cut me from my past, when the Lord Jehovah saw fit to enlighten me with the truth. And as he has chosen me for a new role, I must, as Paul so wisely recommended in his epistle to the Corinthians, put away childish things, allowing earlier incarnations of myself to be enveloped into a great smog in which, said Ryan Tops, taking only the smallest breath and his cutlery from Hortense, it appears that your mother, and any memory I might have of her, have disappeared.
She never mentioned you either, said Irie.
Well, it was all a long time ago now, said
Hortense with forced joviality.
But you did try your best with her, Mr. Tapps. She was my miracle child, Clara. I was 48. I thought she was God's child. But Clara was born for evil. She never was a godly girl, and in the end there was nothing to be done.
He will send down his vengeance, Mrs. B, said Ryan with more cheerful animation than Irie had yet seen him display. He will send terrible torture to those who have earned it. 3 plantain for me, if you please.
Hortense set all 3 plates down, and Irie, realizing she hadn't eaten since the previous morning, scraped a mountain of plantain onto her plate.
Ah, oh, it's hot. Better hot than lukewarm,
said Hortense grimly with a meaningful shudder.
Ever so. Amen.
Amen, echoed Ryan, braving the red-hot plantain. Amen. So, what exactly is it that you are studying?
He asked, looking so intently past Irie that it took a moment before she realized he was addressing her.
Chemistry, biology, and religious studies.
Irie blew on a hot piece of plantain.
I want to be a dentist.
Ryan perked up.
Religious studies? And do they acquaint you with the only true church?
Irie shifted in her seat.
I guess it's more the big 3. Jews, Christians, Muslims. We did a month on Catholicism.
Ryan grimaced.
And do you have any other interests?
Irie considered.
Music. I like music. Concerts, clubs, that kind of thing.
Yes. I used to go in for all that myself at one time, until the good news was delivered unto me. Large gatherings of youth, of the kind that frequent popular concerts, are commonly breeding grounds for devil worship. A girl of your physical assets might find herself lured into the lascivious arms of a sexualist, said Ryan, standing up from the table and looking at his watch. Now that I think about it, in a certain light you look a lot like your mother. Similar cheekbones.
Ryan wiped a pearly line of sweat from his forehead. There was a silence in which Hortense stood motionless, clinging nervously to a dishcloth, and Irie had to physically cross the room for a glass of water to remove herself from Mr. Topps's stare.
Well, that's 20 minutes and counting, Mrs. B. I'll get the gear, shall I?
Oh, yes, Mr. Tapps, said Hortense, beaming.
But the moment Ryan left the room, the beam turned into a scowl.
Why must you go and say things like that, You want him to think you're some devilish heathen gal? Why can't you say stamp collecting or something? Come on, I got to clean these plates. Finish up.
Ivory looked at the pile of food left on her plate and guiltily tapped her stomach.
Chuh! Just as I suspect. Your eyes see more than your belly can hold. Give it here.
Hortense leant against the sink and began popping bits of plantain into her mouth.
No, you don't backchat Mr. Tops while you're here. You got study to do and he got study too, said Hortense, lowering her voice. He's in consultation with the Brooklyn gentleman at the moment, fixing the final date. No mistakes this time. You just have to look at the trouble going on in the world to know we're not far from the appointed day.
I won't be any trouble, said Irie, approaching the washing up as a gesture of goodwill. He just seems a little weird.
The ones who are chosen by the Lord always seem peculiar to the heathen. Mr. Tapps is just misunderstood. It mean a lot to me. Me never have nobody before. Your mother don't like to tell you since she got all highty-tighty, but the Bowden family have had it hard long time. I was born during an earthquake, almost killed before I was born. And then when me a fully grown woman, my own daughter run from me. Me never see my only grand picnic. I only have the Lord all them years. Mr. Tapps is the first human man who look upon me and take pity and care. Your mother was a fool to let him go. True, sir.
Irie gave it one last try.
What? What does that mean? Oh, nothing. Nothing. Dear Lord, I and I talking all over the place this morning. Oh, Mr. Tapps, there you are. We're not going to be late now, are we?
Mr. Tops, who had just re-entered the room, was fully adorned in leather from head to toe, a huge motorcycle helmet on his head, a small red light attached to his left ankle, and a small white light strapped to his right. He flipped up the visor.
No, we are all right, by the grace of God. Where's your helmet, Mrs. B?
Oh, I've started keeping it in the oven. Keeps it warm and toasty on the cold mornings. Irie Ambrosia, fetch it for me, please.
Sure enough, on the middle shelf, preheated to gas mark II, sat Hortense's helmet. Irie scooped it out and carefully fitted it over her grandmother's plasticated carnations. You ride a motorbike, said Irie, by way of conversation. But Mr. Top seemed defensive.
A G.S. Vespa. Nothing fancy. I did think about giving it away at one point. It represented a life I'd rather forget, if you get my meaning. A motorbike is a sexual magnet, and God forgive me, but I misused it in that fashion. I was all set on getting rid of it, but then Mrs. B convinced me that with all my public speaking, I need something quick to get around on. And Mrs. B don't want to be messing about with buses and trains at her age, do you, Mrs. B?
No, indeed. He got me this little buggy.
Sidecar, corrected Ryan, tetchily. It's called a sidecar. Minetto motorcycle combination, 1973 model.
Yes, of course, a sidecar. And it is comfortable as a bed. We go everywhere in it, Mr. Tops and I.
Hortense took down her overcoat from a hook on the door and reached in the pockets for two Velcro reflector bands, which she strapped round each arm.
Now, Irie, I've got a great deal of business to be getting on with today, so you're going to have to cook for yourself, because I can't tell what time we'll be home. But don't worry, Miss Soon come.
No problem. Hortense sucked her teeth.
No problem. That's what her name mean in patois. Irie. No problem. Now, what kind of a name is that to?
Mr. Tops didn't answer. He was already out on the pavement, revving up the Vespa.
First I have to keep her from those chalfins,
growls Clara over the phone, her voice a resonant tremolando of anger and fear.
And now you people again.
On the other end, her mother takes the washing out of the machine and listens silently through the cordless that is tucked between ear and weary shoulder, biding her time.
Hortense, I don't want you filling her head with a whole load of nonsense. You hear me? Your mother was fool to it, and then you were fool to it, but the buck stopped with me and it ain't going no further. If Irie comes home spouting any of that claptrap, you can forget about the second coming, 'cause you'll be dead by the time it arrives.
Big words. But how fragile is Clara's atheism? Like one of those tiny glass doves Hortense keeps in the lounge cabinet, A breath would knock it over. Talking of which, Clara still holds hers when passing churches the same way adolescent vegetarians scurry by butchers. She avoids Kilburn on a Saturday for fear of street-side preachers on their upturned apple crates. Hortense senses Clara's terror, coolly cramming in another load of whites and measuring out the liquid with a thrifty woman's eye. She is short and decided.
Don't you worry about Irie Ambrosia. She in a good place now. She'll tell you herself.
As if she had ascended with the heavenly host rather than entombed herself below ground in the borough of Lambeth with Ryan Tops. Clara hears her daughter getting on the extension, an initial crackle, and then a voice as clear as a carillon. Look, I'm not coming home. All right, so don't bother. I'll be back when I'm back, just don't worry about me. And there should be nothing to worry about, and there is nothing to worry about, except maybe that outside in the streets it is cold, packed on cold. Even the dog shit has crystallized. There is the first suggestion of ice on the windscreens, and Clara has been in that house through the winter. She knows what it means. Oh, wonderfully bright at 6 a.m. Yes, wonderfully clear for an hour. But the shorter the days, the longer the nights, the darker the house, the easier it is, the easier it is, the easier it is to mistake a shadow for the writing on the wall, the sound of overland footsteps for the distant crack of thunder, and the midnight chime of a New Year clock for the bell that tolls the end of the world. But Clara needn't have feared. Irie's atheism was robust. It was chalfinist in its confidence, and she approached her stay with Hortense with detached amusement. She was intrigued by the Bowden household. It was a place of endgames and aftertimes, full stops and finales, where to count on the arrival of tomorrow was an indulgence, and every service in the house, from the milkman to the electricity, was paid for on a strictly daily basis so as not to spend money on utilities or goods that would be wasted should God turn up in all his holy vengeance the very next day. Bowdenism gave a whole new meaning to the phrase hand to mouth. This was living in the eternal instant, ceaselessly teetering on the precipice of total annihilation. There are people who take a great deal of drugs simply to experience something comparable to 84-year-old Hortense Bowden's day-to-day existence. So you've seen dwarfs rip open their bellies and show you their insides. You've been a television switched off without warning. You've experienced the whole world as one Krishna consciousness, free of individual ego, floating through the infinite cosmos of the soul. Big fucking deal. That's all bullshit next to St. John's trip when Christ laid the 22 chapters of Revelation on him. It must have been a hell of a shock for the apostle. After that thorough spin job, the New Testament, all those sweet words and sublime sentiments, to discover Old Testament vengeance lurking round the corner after all. As many as I love, I rebuke and chasten. That must have been some eye-opener. Revelation is where all crazy people end up. It's the last stop on the Nutso Express. And Bowdenism, which was the Witnesses plus Revelation, and then some, was as left-field as they come. Par exemple. Hortense Bowden interpreted Revelation, chapter 3, verse 15. I know thy works, that thou art neither cold nor hot. I would thou wert cold or hot. So then, because thou art lukewarm, and neither cold nor hot, I will spew thee out of my mouth, as a literal mandate. She understood lukewarm to be an evil property in and of itself. She kept a microwave on hand at all times, her sole concession to modern technology. For a long time it was a toss-up between pleasing the Lord and laying oneself open to the United States mind ray control program, as operated through high-frequency radio waves, in order to heat every meal to an impossible temperature. She kept whole buckets of ice to chill every glass of water colder than cold. She wore two pairs of knickers at all times, like a wary potential traffic victim. When Irie asked why, she sheepishly revealed that upon hearing the first signs of the Lord, approaching thunder, bellowing voice, Wagner's ring cycle, she intended to whip off the one closest to her and replace it with the outer pair, so that Jesus would find her fresh and odorless and ready for heaven. She kept a tub of black paint in the hallway, so when the time came, she might daub the neighbours' doors with the sign of the beast, saving the Lord all that trouble of weeding out the baddies, separating sheep from goats. And you couldn't form any sentence in that house which included the words end, finished, done, etc. For these were like so many triggers setting off both Hortense and Ryan with the usual ghoulish relish. Irie. I finished the washing up. Ryan tops.